This is Jeffrey Thrall with Frank Prattle. You're listening to Neighborhood Public Radio, 88.9 FM in San Francisco. I'm live here, well, live recorded, with Matthew Higgs of White Columns at NADA Art Fair in Miami. Right now, it's just straight Miami, Florida.
Straight Miami.
Hi, Matthew.
Hi.
Tell us a little bit about what White Columns is doing down here at the NADA Art Fair.
White Columns is the oldest alternative not-for-profit art gallery in New York City. It was founded in 1970 by Gordon Mallet Clark and Jeffrey Liu, two artists with the intention of supporting the work of emerging and artists that they felt had been overlooked. And 36 years later, White Columns' mission remains intact. The intention of the space is to do just that, to support the work of emerging artists and those artists that we feel, for one reason or another, haven't got the attention they deserve. And White Columns is invited to the NADA Art Fair, along with a handful of other not-for-profit organizations, to take part in the fair. And I guess on the one hand, there's a kind of sort of philanthropy from the commercial fair to organizations like us, but I think more pointedly for a small organization like White Columns with a small budget, it gives us access to audiences, people, conversations that perhaps we wouldn't have at our base in New York City.
Right.
It also gives us an opportunity, I think, to represent ourselves through the artists we've worked with. So at the space we have at the fair, we're showing the work of around 12 or 15, I think, very different kind of artists that together represent some of the eccentricities, perhaps, of the program that we've been working on recently. And for me, it's an interesting context because, you know, I think the key things we can provide for artists are visibility in a context and hopefully locate their ideas within a larger conversation and dialogue. But also I think, and I think it was important from White Columns' perspective from the beginning, was to try and create an economy for artists. So for the most part, these are artists who are showing at the very early stage in their career. And if we're able to sell work for them, or we're able to introduce them to people who might subsequently be able to sell their work, it's part of a process of allowing artists to create an autonomy for themselves, to allow them to do what they want to do, which is to make work. So I think we're interested in the fact that we are showing within the framework of an economic context, but also as a not-for-profit, I think it's an interesting paradox. I think it's a paradox that we can successfully and hopefully interestingly intervene in.
How many artists does White Columns typically work with?
I mean, since it began, it's showed the work of more than 30,000 artists, I think, something in that region. Since I've been the director, for 2 years, we've done a lot of programs. We've organized around 45 shows in the last 2 years. And part
That's
of my intention was to get new energy into the building. And I think also when I became the director of White Columns, my feeling was that White Columns had become a little too inward-looking. It was very New York-centric. And this certainly was a paradox because obviously the world had got bigger, the world had got much more porous with globalism and communication, but perversely, White Columns had actually become more local, and this seemed to me not productive. So I think one of the first things I wanted to do was to change some of the dynamics about where the artists come from. So certainly we've started working with artists from all over North America and now internationally, and I would say 51% of our programs come from somewhere else, and 50%-ish remain New York. I think it's essential that we retain a very kind of local conversation, but it seems important to me that we broaden it. So certainly we've established a pretty substantial dialogue with artists working in the Bay Area. I think we probably worked with around 10 of Bay Area artists in the last year. Similarly, artists working in other cities in the United States. And also, you know, we've taken White Columns outside of itself. So we've done projects recently in Milwaukee, Portland, Oregon. We'll be doing a project in the New Year in Boston, something like here in Miami. And for me, it's important that White Columns doesn't simply become a New York-centric thing. And it's also important for me that I think New York, I think, for many reasons, probably some of them good reasons, I think assumes that everything will eventually come to it because of its kind of fiscal authority, scale, etc.
The vortex.
Yeah, but I certainly think a lot of material just doesn't get seen in New York, or it doesn't get seen quickly enough. And I think that's one of the things we can do because we don't represent artists. We have a very kind of light administration. I think we can make these conversations happen much quicker. And certainly, I think the conversation, just as a for example, with the Bay Area has been really productive on all levels. And, you know, it's something we want to keep doing. We recently just made a small project in London, England, and I think there's no reason why we can't, in a kind of sort of samizdat or semi-viral way, just find ourselves in other situations.
One of the artists that's definitely showcased very, you know, largely at your booth here at NADA is Coulter Jacobson.
Uh-huh.
What's your feelings on Coulter?
Well, you know, Coulter, I came across when I was living in the Bay Area, and he organized an incredibly beautiful show at the Harvey Milk Library in the Castro. And the show was really, it was a group show, but Coulter had invited a number of artists almost to make a collective portrait of two Bay Area writers, Dodi Bellamy and Kevin Killian, who we've also worked with at White Commons, and we'll work with Dodi again in January. And it was an incredibly beautiful show organized by an artist. It was like a portrait of two people presented within the context of a public library in, you know, a very particular neighborhood. And I thought there was something very magical about the kind of associative way Coulter put things together. And I didn't really know he was an artist. And subsequently got to see his work, and I think he's working in an incredibly sort of interesting way, but it worked quite conceptual in its origin or how it's structured. He might make drawings based on memory. He might make drawings based on the fact that the only consistent or common thing is the presence of a wristwatch in an image. There's this use of time. And what I thought beyond that was there was this kind of conceptual armature to the work, but the works themselves are highly emotive, very personal. So I thought somehow he'd managed to collide a very sort of strange, poetic, emotive, biographical material with this kind of conceptual framework. But then working it all through an ultimately quite traditional medium, which is pencil, graphite pencil drawings on paper. So I thought there was something really interesting about his tone of voice. And I think, you know, it's no surprise that I discovered he's also a writer, quite connected to the Bay Area literary scene, which would fold back into the project of the Harvey Milk Library. And I just felt it was distinctive. And I thought, I think it's quite common to a lot of artists working in the Bay Area, not just in art, but also in music, where there's kind of sort of idiosyncraticness to the work. Certainly a lot of people are interested, I think, in vernacular art forms, whether it's folk art, whether it's kind of outsider art, street art, or certain kinds of aesthetics that perhaps have a relationship, long-standing relationship with the Bay Area, whether it's in the collagists, Bay Area Dada stuff in the 60s and 70s and so on. So I think there was these kind of histories that Coulter's work was working within literary traditions too, obviously. But at the same time, it just felt kind of fresh. So we showed him in a group show in New York about a year and a half ago. I had a great response to it. And then had an opportunity to show his work at the Armory show.
Right.
And now here. And then from that situation, you know, he's now represented and working with a really great gallery in London called Corby Mora. So again, it's, you know, it's given Coulter a platform to make the work and show the work. And, you know, we're thrilled to have been a part of that.
Who are some of the artists that you're looking at now for the future?
I'm trying to think off the top of my head. I mean, in the last 2 years, I think we've shown the work of 350 artists at the gallery.
It's quite a plate.
And we have an online registry that artists can submit work to. And last year, 4,500 artists submitted their work for me to look at. And myself and my colleague, Amy Scally, who's the curator at White Combs, we methodically review all of this material.
So
it takes ages.
Do you personally review?
Yeah, absolutely. It takes a long time. So I think we're currently about a year behind schedule. But I think it's important that, you know, we encourage people to submit material. So it's not like some galleries where the material is sent unsolicited. We're actively encouraging people to submit this work. And,
right.
And, you know, from this, we're seeing stuff that, you know, we simply wouldn't have access to because we can't be everywhere. We can't travel everywhere. We don't have the budget to travel in that way. So we're seeing work through that context. We're also seeing work from elsewhere. And one of the things we've really been doing is trying to establish an intergenerational program. I think, you know, a lot of the way that the art market is being driven at the minute is about youth. A lot of talk about very recent graduates being shown immediately out of school. And, you know, that's fine, but it doesn't seem to me it's the most interesting conversation. And certainly the program, I would say, of White Combs in the last 2 years has been a conversation between artists in mid-career, very established artists who perhaps have somewhat disappeared from view, and then working alongside younger artists. And I'm very interested in this intergenerational dialogue. And very recently showed the photographs of Judy Lynn, I think a really wonderful New York-based photographer who's not well enough known. And she did some of the early Patti Smith records sleeves, and she taught Robert Mapplethorpe how to make photographs and how to print photographs, but she's just not as widely known as she should be. And we did a small show with her at White Combs, and as a result of that, she's going to have a first career survey and publication in an institution in Canada. I think that's what we can do. I think that's what we can do best, is to provide a platform and a context for all kinds of artists.
Right.
I think it's essential that it is all kinds of artists, and that it's not a particular homogenous or dogmatic program. I don't think that would make any sense for... My feeling about White Combs is that it was begun by a group of artists in the spirit of generosity. It was like a gesture to a community. And its primary audience was artists. And our primary audience, I still think, remains artists. So I think it's in that spirit of generosity that we try to function and try to operate. And it's really just to create an open, porous model where the artist is the primary focus. And the organization, I think, in many respects, should be as visible as possible in terms of its how it's structured and how it's organized and how it functions. Really, it's just trying to create this sort of porous model.
And you being in a fairly small organization, how much time do you think you devote to actually curating art and dealing with artists versus fundraising?
I'm the director and chief curator, so I'm responsible for raising all the money and partly responsible for all of the program.
Right.
And I think right now I'd say it's around 50-50.
Really?
But which seems, you know, okay. I think if the directorial administrative stuff started to overtake that, I would certainly lose interest in it, because it seems to me my interest is in working with artists. And then the background on that is that we have to find the money to be able to work with them.
Right.
And the organization has, you know, quite modest budget, and it has quite modest goals financially. I don't want the organization to become too big. I don't want to go on a capital campaign to build a new building.
Right.
These things are completely unnecessary. I think my interest is making the idea of White Combs much bigger. And the idea of White Combs doesn't need a bigger building. It doesn't need a bigger space. It doesn't need a marketing department. It doesn't need any of those things in order for the idea to become bigger. So that's what we're trying to develop, is to amplify what the organization is and what the organization can do without necessarily adding new layers of bureaucracy or administration. So there's only four people work for the organization, and we mostly do everything.
Right.
And I've always been interested in that too, because, you know, I trained as an artist and I just continue to show as an artist, and I'm very interested in the multiple roles artists have to occupy, usually out of necessity, but I think also that they choose to occupy, the way that they artist writer, artist musician, these kind of things, these sort of hybrid identities. And I think that's certainly something I'm interested in professionally. So the idea of being a director and a curator simultaneously, I find interesting, because they both require different mindsets, but at the same time, I think it's possible to infiltrate the director side with an artistic mentality, as it is to infiltrate the curatorial side with a more logistical mentality. So I like those kind of confusions.
You had written recently in Art Forum about your trip to Milwaukee and White Columns going there for an art fair, and I was just wondering if you'd share a few words on that. Your experience there versus your experience here at NADA?
Well, you know, the Milwaukee International was a very beautiful and strange event. It was an art fair of sorts organized by a group of Milwaukee-based artists. And I think what was interesting was that they took this kind of now very ubiquitous model, which is the art fair. If you come to Miami, there's 6, 7, 8 satellite fairs at least. And I think they sort of understood that it was actually just an interesting framework that people can understand. And I think in quite a subversive way, they use it as an opportunity to bring a lot of people to Milwaukee who might otherwise never have visited. So in a way, they created a reason to come. It's a bit like the movie where Wayne's World, where they book them and they will come. So they want to book Aerosmith, and you believe it, it'll happen. And it kind of felt like that. So all of a sudden, there were 30 spaces from around the world in Milwaukee. And it seemed to me it was very organic, it was very grassroots, and but done with a kind of a very beautiful sensibility. And I don't think anybody expected to make any money. I don't think anybody did make any money. But I think what happened was there was a sense of community was fostered. And it was based on the fact that a community exists there. You know, albeit a small community of really smart, interesting artists. But they were intelligent enough to connect their community to other communities. And I think there's a real sense of adventure came out of that situation. Quite different, I think, to the situation, let's say, NADA. But, you know, I think NADA is interesting, too, because it was founded as a not-for-profit organization by a group of young emerging art dealers who I think were very close in age to the artists they were working with. So when NADA began, I think it grew out of a sense of a need for younger emerging artists and dealers. But clearly the economy and the scale and the audience is quite different here. So in Milwaukee, there is no market.
Right.
And I think that was what was interesting about the idea of clearly a curious paradox of creating an art fair where there's no market. Playing off that kind of tension. Clearly here in Miami there's a market. There's thousands of people in town who are interested in quite possibly world by art. So I think there's kind of a reality to this context that's quite different, I think, from Milwaukee. But Milwaukee was magical, and I think it was for White Columns, it was another great way for us to take ourselves outside of ourselves. And I think we can't have any assumptions about how White Columns functions as an idea outside of our space in New York, because even if NADA, people don't know who we are, they've never heard of us, they don't know what we are, they don't know why a not-for-profit organization is at the bar. So you have to do a lot of talking, which for us is good because it means we have to keep thinking about what we are and who we are and why we're trying to do things. And similarly, I think in Milwaukee, it was interesting to find ourselves in a context we knew nothing about. It gives us an opportunity to think about ourselves. Certainly, having the opportunity or the platform in Art Forum magazine to talk more broadly about the changes in the not-for-profit community, I think they're very interesting right now. I think the art market has grown to such a size that it's become a kind of self-serving and self-functioning force. But at the same time, the larger museums and institutions, I think, are similarly separated from the activity of how art actually gets made and discussed. It seems to me like it's an interesting time for not-profits to reclaim some of that center ground. Because certainly in the late 70s and through the mid-80s, these spaces were like Artist Space, for example, or The Kitchen or White Columns at the time, they were hugely influential. New Langton Arts in San Francisco, hugely influential in shaping the culture that is now mainstream. And I think it's important that collectively and independently we start to think those thoughts again. Certainly I think you see a lot of interesting things unfolding in New York City, but also elsewhere. There's a very interesting new space, LAX in Los Angeles. Yeah. And I think all of a sudden the idea of a not-for-profit idea of a more independently minded, more artist-centered, more artist-focused organizations and smaller organizations, because of course everything in the world's got bigger. Chelsea Gallery's got bigger.
Right.
I think people are interested in downsizing. I think people are very interested in trying to bring the scale back to a more human, humane, physical, tangible level.
Right.
And certainly that's something we're interested in. I think White Columns space in New York is a decent sized space, but relatively modest. And I think that modest scale is quite important to retain.
When you're looking at artists, what do you tend to look for? What catches your eye? Just on a general scale?
Well, I don't know. I think if you've had a chance to visit the booth, or if you've had a chance to visit White Columns over the last couple of years, I think we're trying extremely eclectic material. And all kinds of material. Material has very different motivations, very different intentions. And I guess all I ever look for is, it's work that has a kind of assuredness, kind of self-confidence. And I don't mean it has a kind of sort of aggressive or arrogant pitch, but work that has a kind of quiet authority and idiosyncratic. I think we see a lot of work that looks like other things, that reminds one of other things, or that has it kind of carries its history with it.
Right.
And I'm very interested in tracing a work's genealogy, but at the end of the day I think you also want the work to have a kind of a identity of its own.
Right.
And I think an example would be Colter Jacobson's drawings, which for the most part are quite conventional, but they don't have a conventional atmosphere. There's something about them that's discordant. Something about the relationship between the two images within a single work that's not quite right.
Right.
And I think in that not quite rightness, the work starts to unfold and open up for itself and presents itself as wholly original, I think. But I think those qualities are largely elusive. And it's like what's how would one define a great piece of music? And I think it's that relationship between elusiveness, subjectiveness, and then I think identifiable qualities. Something's well made or something's well enough made in order to convey or do what it's supposed to do. Those things combined and you end up with interesting art.
Sounds
my belief is there's only interesting art and less interesting art. So you know,
there's no bad?
No bad art. There's no bad music.
Well, there's some music that's not quite good, though.
Less interesting.
One of the questions that I have for you also is that you're an incredibly busy man, and how, in the midst of all that, do you fight burnout?
Fight what?
Fight burnout. Or kind of combat, I don't know, losing interest in the whole picture.
I don't know. I mean, it's, without, wanting to sound too wishy-washy, it's my genuine belief that it's miraculous that one's allowed to make art, be involved with artists, work with artists, and, since I was a kid, I was interested in stuff, and I think it's, in a very fundamental way, it's just a way of, opening up one's own limited resources to other possibilities, and, I'm constantly amazed at culture's ability to recycle and reinvent itself, and certainly my greatest pleasure is not the quest for the new, but just being able to monitor or absorb the way that culture incrementally tries to move forward. And I think it's constantly fascinating, and I can't see how you can lose interest. And I'm certainly professionally, I think it's the longer one does this, or the longer one is involved with working with artists or making exhibitions, you build up your own history, and then you relate the new things you see to that history. And that's always interesting for me, is how one contextualizes new ideas in relationship to one's own experience and one's developing experience. So for me, it's every day seems really exciting. Every day offers the possibility of being introduced to something you could never have imagined before, seeing something you've never seen, being encouraged to think about something in a way you couldn't have imagined before. And, I don't know, it seems like a small miracle that such a thing can exist, and I think that's enough for me. I mean, it's, boredom would seem to be the enemy, and part of the way to fight boredom, I think, is to seek out other stuff. And I think certainly being in a position to help support people, to help provide opportunities for other people, to collaborate and work with other people is a kind of renewing process.
I just wondered, because many people in similar positions to yourself seem completely inundated in it and just frazzled, and you definitely seem to be pretty calm and together.
Well, we could be doing a lot worse things to make a living and have a lot more tough life, so I feel very fortunate that I'm allowed to do this. So I think it's kind of an obligation to try and work with and help as many people as possible. So it's I have friends I grew up with who are pretty routine, mundane, probably quite depressing working lives, and it seems to me that it's such a honor to be able to do this, but it's a responsibility, I think, and I think it's certainly running an organization that was started in the 70s and has been thousands of people have put their love and energy into the space. It's a huge responsibility to be in charge of it, because it's not my space. It's an idea that was set in motion a long time ago by Gordon Matta-Clark and Jeffrey Liu, and we're the custodians of that idea, and it's a huge responsibility to make sure it remains a compelling idea, because when they started it, it was a very, very important gesture. It began the whole alternative art space movement of the 1970s.
Right.
And, we have a moral and economic and cultural responsibility to make sure that idea continues to grow and thrive and nurture and nourish it. And for me, that's like an exciting thing to be left in charge of. And, that's part of why one's constantly trying to find new things, work with new people, include as many people as possible, and enlarge the conversation.
That's great. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
My name is Zephyr. This has been Frank Prattle. You're listening to Neighborhood Public Radio, 88.9 FM, and I've been on with Matthew Higgs of White Columns in New York. Thank you.